A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi, Herman and Corin. I was taking a look the other day at Israel's national online data system, which is at data.gov.il for those who'd like to take a peek at the data that Israel's government open sources. The translation aspect of it is particularly not the best, I would say. It's Hebrew, and even to get English column names, I had to write a script to do that, but it's on GitHub if anyone wants to use it. But I'd love to talk less about the specifics of Israel's national data platform and more about these platforms generally, because I have to admit that I'm a little bit skeptical, you could say, based on my experience with these. It was interesting when I was looking at the Israeli data portal to see that it was built on CCAN, and I was looking at a project for impact investing a year ago or so, in which we wanted to gather together different data sets of relevance across the ecosystem. And I was looking for platforms for those data catalogs things we've all probably seen. It was actually weirdly hard to do because 90% plus of the products were geared towards enterprise data discovery. But CKAN, C-K-A-N, for those looking for the tool, is this big open source project. It's kind of the classic for data publishing. So I recognized the platform and looked at the API, which I knew roughly how it tends to be shaped. And I was trying to figure out, firstly, is any of this stuff actually interesting? And I was going through the collection, and some of them seemed almost comically obscure. You had one data set about vendor stores in Ben Gurion Airport. So the Israeli government has curated and open sourced a list, if you're interested to know who actually has a stall at Ben Gurion. Is it Stymatsky? Is it a croissant deli? That information's in the public domain. But I would regard the utility of that information as either minimal, or is the government trolling us by saying this is what we're going to release? Like, it's almost such a strange thing to put out there. The things I was looking for, data on trying to find actually the source of the consumer, the house price index data that's constantly referenced in coverage. I eventually found it not on this data portal, but on CBS, which is the Israeli national stats body. And I think that actually says a lot about how these data portals are often, and this is where I say I feel a bit skeptical, performative, in the sense that it doesn't cost a fortune for a government to gather together some data sets from across different departments under the kind of banner of digital transparency, digital transformation, and they'll get it and they'll publish it. But often, and I say this even about some of the UN open data platforms, IMF has one, they're kind of like this bewildering sea of information. And I guess that's partially by design. They expect people to dig and to look through it, but they do nothing. And sometimes it even feels like they're going out of their way to make them unfriendly to explore. Now, someone even more cynical than me, and I'm not putting myself at quite this level, would say that's by design. They don't want you to look. I don't think personally that's the reason. I think it's just a lack of real desire to do this well. So we can look at kind of how these data portals, the distinction that I think I'd love to explore is that often wide ground between what is just, here's data that we're going to share with you. We're doing the open data thing, right? We have the license, we have the name, and an actual genuine good faith effort to say, and I think this is maybe idealized, but what it could be, okay, we're sitting on mountains of data. This is some of it that is available, and who knows? If you're a researcher or you're a journalist or you're just interested, feel free to download millions of rows of data and analyze as you see fit. If you find anything useful, let us know. I think there's actually a potential for a loop there between journalism, civil society, and government to actually do useful things with the data that might drive more informed policymaking. But it's a loop that I rarely see actually done. You know, Herman and Corinne, that one of our, I think, favorite things about this podcast is I love to challenge you to find examples that show the positive potential here, rather than spending our time dwelling on what it looks like when open data is done poorly. What are some examples you can point to where governments have engaged in efforts to open source data, whether at the municipal or national level, that actually created a useful surface for engaged citizens to explore, find some useful things, and maybe even gone all the way to this kind of more cooperative model that I'm talking about? In other words, open government data actually done well, where transparency is more than just uploading a random CSV file and hoping that maybe someone will look at it. Herman and Corinne, over to you.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been poking around Israel's national open data portal, data.gov.il, and came away with what I'd call a very specific kind of disappointment. The kind where you want to believe in the thing, but the thing keeps handing you a CSV of airport vendor listings and calling it transparency.
Which is a rich starting point, because the Ben-Gurion airport vendor dataset is genuinely one of the more memorable things I've heard described. It's almost performance art. Here is the state, solemnly informing you that there is, in fact, a Stamatsky in Terminal 3.
The government wants you to know, we have croissants. This is official.
The question underneath it is serious. Open government data portals. These things have been around in earnest for about 15 years now, and the gap between what they promise and what they deliver is, in a lot of cases, a chasm. The prompt is asking us to find the examples where that gap actually closes. Where open data isn't just a CSV graveyard, but something that created a real surface for citizens, journalists, researchers to actually do something useful. And ideally, where it looped back into policy.
The airport vendor list is the control group. That's our baseline for, we uploaded a thing, please clap.
And I want to defend that baseline for about 5 seconds before we leave it behind, because there is a species of open data advocate who will tell you that even the weird, obscure datasets matter. That you never know what someone will do with it. And there's a grain of truth there. I've seen researchers do remarkable things with datasets that seem pointless on first glance. But that defense collapses when the portal is so hard to use that nobody will ever find the dataset in the first place. The prompt's point about these platforms being bewildering seas of information is not wrong.
It's the difference between having a library and having a warehouse. A library has a catalog. A librarian, some sense of what's where. A warehouse has boxes. Most of these portals are warehouses with a search bar that was clearly designed by someone who hates you.
CKA, EMAO, which is the platform underneath a huge number of these, it's the open source data portal software that Israel uses, that the US uses for data.gov, that the UK uses, that something like 40 national governments and dozens of cities run on. CKAN is a perfectly capable piece of software. But it's a framework. It's not a user experience. If you install CKAN and do nothing else, what you get is basically a spreadsheet with a URL. The prompt's observation that translation was a nightmare on the Israeli portal. That's not a CKAN problem, that's a deployment problem. Someone had to decide to invest in multilingual metadata, and they didn't.
Well, they did it halfway. Which in some ways is worse, because you can see the ghost of the intention.
So let's do what the prompt asks and look at the positive examples, because they do exist. And I want to start with the one that I think most people in the open data world point to as the gold standard, which is the UK's data.gov.uk. Now, the UK launched this in 2010, which makes it one of the older national portals. But what made it different wasn't the launch, it was the institutional scaffolding around it.
Scaffolding meaning what, specifically?
They created something called the Open Data Institute in 2012, co-founded by Tim Berners-Lee and Nigel Shadbolt. The ODI wasn't just a cheerleader, it was an active intermediary. It ran training programs for civil servants on how to publish data well, not just how to dump a CSV. It built partnerships with newsrooms. It funded startups that built products on top of government data. And crucially, it created a feedback mechanism where data users could flag problems, missing datasets, formatting issues, broken links, and those flags actually went somewhere.
It wasn't upload and walk away. There was a living relationship between the publisher and the users.
And that produced some useful outcomes. One of the canonical examples is the Prescribing Data Project. The NHSS publishes data on what medications are prescribed by every GP practice in England, millions of rows. It's granular down to the individual practice and the individual drug, and it was published as open data. What happened was that a group of data journalists and researchers started analyzing it and found massive variations in prescribing patterns. Some practices were prescribing brand-name drugs where generic equivalents existed, costing the NHSS hundreds of millions of pounds. That analysis got picked up by newspapers, it got debated in Parliament, and it directly led to changes in prescribing guidelines that saved the NHSS, something like £200 million a year.
That's the loop. That's exactly the loop the prompt is describing. Data goes out, analysis comes back, policy changes, and it's not just, here's a number, be impressed. It's money.
Real money, demonstrable. And the thing is, the NHS didn't publish that data thinking someone will find prescribing inefficiencies. They published it because it was on a list of datasets that could be opened. The value was discovered by the users. But the discovery was possible because the data was published with enough care that it was actually usable. Proper documentation, consistent formatting, regular updates.
This is where I want to push on something. Because the UK example is often held up, and it's real. But it's also a country with a fairly robust institutional culture around data. What about places where the starting point is messier? Because the prompt's experience with the Israeli portal wasn't, this data is bad. It was, I can't find the data I actually want, and what I can find is airport vendors.
Let me give you a municipal example that I think is instructive, because cities sometimes move faster than national governments on this stuff. Chicago's Open Data Portal launched in 2010 under Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and it now has something like 600 datasets. But the interesting part isn't the volume. It's that Chicago embedded open data into its actual governance processes in a way that created a feedback loop.
What does embedded mean?
The city created a dedicated role, the Chief Data Officer, and gave that office actual authority. Every city department had to publish certain datasets on a schedule, not as a one-off. The CDO's office ran regular open data meetups where they'd bring in civic hackers, journalists, community groups, and say, here's what we just published, what can you do with it, what do you need next? And there's a specific outcome I want to highlight, which is the food inspection data.
Restaurant health inspections?
Chicago published every restaurant health inspection result as structured open data. What happened was that a group of civic coders built an app, actually several apps, that mapped those inspections onto a searchable interface. So you could pull up any restaurant and see its inspection history. But here's where it gets interesting. The city noticed that the app was being used, and they started using the usage data to prioritize inspections. Restaurants with recent violations that were getting a lot of lookups got inspected again sooner. The data loop created an enforcement loop, and the whole thing was driven by the fact that the data was published in a format that made third-party use trivial.
That's a nice inversion of the usual dynamic. Usually, it's government publishes, citizens consume. Here it was, government publishes, citizens build tools, government uses those tools to do its job better.
Chicago isn't alone. New York City has a similar story with its 311 data. The city publishes every 311 service request, noise complaints, pothole reports, broken streetlights, as open data updated daily. Researchers at NYU analyzed the data and found that response times for complaints in wealthier neighborhoods were systematically faster than in lower-income neighborhoods. That finding made it into a city council hearing, and it directly informed changes in how the city allocates its repair crews. Again, data goes out, analysis comes back, policy responds.
There's a pattern emerging here, which is that the successful examples all have some kind of intermediary layer. It's not just government to citizen. It's government to intermediary, to citizen, and then back again. The intermediary is doing the translation work that the government isn't doing itself.
And I think that's actually the key insight. When you look at open data portals that are useful, you almost always find a thriving ecosystem of intermediaries. Data journalists, civic tech groups, academic researchers, open source developers, who are doing the work of turning raw data into something legible. The government's job in this model isn't to make the data beautiful. It's to make the data reliable, well-documented, and consistently available. The intermediaries handle the rest.
Which brings me back to the prompt's point about the Israeli portal. If the translation is bad, if the column names are in Hebrew and there's no English metadata, you've basically walled off the global intermediary ecosystem. You're relying entirely on local intermediaries who can read Hebrew and have the time to write translation scripts. That's a much smaller pool.
It's a solvable problem. The prompt mentioned writing a script to handle the translation. That's exactly the kind of thing a well-resourced open data program would have done on the publishing side. It's not technically hard. It's an institutional prioritization question.
Let me ask you about a case that I think complicates the rosy picture. What about datasets that are sensitive, or where publication creates perverse incentives? I'm thinking of crime data. If you publish granular crime statistics, you get neighborhood-level transparency, which is good, but you also get real estate agents steering people away from certain areas, which can deepen segregation.
That's a real tension, and it's one the open data community has been grappling with for years. The standard response used to be, publish everything, let the users sort it out. That position has softened considerably. The current thinking, which I think is more mature, is that you do a privacy and equity review before publication, and you accept that some data sets need to be aggregated or anonymized in ways that reduce their granularity but protect people.
That creates a new gatekeeping problem. Who decides what's too sensitive?
And that's why the institutional design matters so much. If the chief data officer reports to the mayor's political staff, you get one set of decisions. If they report to an independent commission, you get another. The UK has a reasonably good model here. Their Open Data Institute operates at arm's length from government, and they have a data ethics framework that's publicly documented. It's not perfect, but it's transparent about the trade-offs.
Let me pull us toward a developing world example, because I think the UK and Chicago stories are useful, but they're also wealthy, English-speaking, high institutional capacity contexts. What does open data done well look like in a place with fewer resources?
I want to talk about Moldova, and I realize that sounds like the setup to a joke, but it's not.
Moldova's open data program. A punchline waiting to happen. But go on.
Moldova launched its open data portal in 2011, and it was, by any measure, a small, resource-constrained effort. But they did something clever. They focused on a handful of high-value datasets. Government spending, procurement contracts, public salaries, and they published them in machine-readable formats with really clear documentation. And they partnered with a local civic tech organization called Monitor, which built a tool called BaniPublic.md, public money, that visualized government expenditure in a way that ordinary citizens could actually understand.
What came of it?
The tool was used by journalists to identify procurement irregularities, contracts awarded to companies that didn't seem to exist, that kind of thing. Several of those investigations led to official audits, and at least one led to a criminal prosecution. But the broader effect was that government agencies started behaving differently because they knew their spending data was going to be public and scrutinized. The transparency changed behavior before the audits did.
That's the deterrence effect. Sunlight is disinfectant, but with an actual mechanism behind the metaphor.
And Moldova's not alone. Ukraine has a platform called Prozoro that covers all public procurement. Every government purchase above a certain threshold is published in real time with full documentation. It was built after the 2014 revolution, specifically as an anti-corruption measure, and it's been remarkably effective. The World Bank estimated it saved Ukraine something like $6 billion in its first 6 years of operation through reduced corruption and more competitive bidding.
$6 billion is not a rounding error. That's real.
The Prozoro model is interesting because it wasn't just, here's a CSV. It was a purpose. Build platform with a clear use case. You want to know what the government is buying, from whom, for how much. The interface was designed for that specific question. It wasn't a general purpose data portal with a search bar and good luck. It was a tool.
This is making me think about the distinction between a data portal and a data product. A portal says, we have many data sets. Explore. A product says, we know what question you're asking, here's the answer, and here's the raw data if you want to dig deeper.
That's a really useful framing, and I think the most successful open data efforts are the ones that blur the line between portal and product. The UK's prescribing data is basically a product. It's published in a consistent schema, it's well documented, there are known use cases, and there's an ecosystem of tools built around it. Chicago's food inspection data is a product. Moldova's public spending data is a product. The airport vendor list is not a product.
It's a CSV-shaped shrug.
A CSV-shaped shrug. I'm going to use that.
If we're advising a government that wants to do this well, and I realize nobody's asking us, but humor me, what's the playbook? What are the three or four things that distinguish a useful open data effort from a performative one?
I'd say the first one is start with use cases, not with datasets. Don't do an inventory of everything you have and dump it online. Ask what questions do citizens, journalists, and researchers actually want to answer, and publish the data that answers those questions. The UK didn't start by publishing everything. They started with a list of about 9,000 datasets that were identified as high value through consultation with users.
Curation before publication.
The second is invest in data quality and documentation. This sounds boring, but it's the thing that separates usable data from landfill. Column names in plain language, consistent date formats, clear definitions of what each field means, documentation of known limitations and gaps. The prompt's experience with untranslated Hebrew column names is exactly the kind of thing that kills usability. A well-run portal would have caught that. Third is build or support the intermediary layer. Fund civic tech fellowships, run hackathons that are actually connected to government needs, hire data journalists in residence. The intermediaries are the force multiplier. A government can publish 1,000 datasets, but if nobody's building tools and telling stories with them, the data sits there inert. Chicago's meetups, the UK's ODI partnerships, Moldova's work with Monitor, these are all examples of actively cultivating the intermediary ecosystem.
Fourth, I'd add, close the loop. If someone finds something in your data, an inefficiency, a pattern, a problem, have a process for that finding to actually reach the relevant decision makers. The prescribing data story works because Parliament paid attention. The Chicago food inspection story works because the health department adjusted its priorities. Without that loop, open data is just a suggestion box that nobody reads.
That loop is the hardest part institutionally, because it requires government agencies to be willing to be corrected by outsiders. That's a cultural shift, not a technical one.
It's also a political shift. If your data reveals that your administration's policies aren't working, the temptation to bury the data or stop publishing it is enormous. The open data commitment has to survive bad news.
Which brings us to an uncomfortable question. How many of these portals actually survive a change of government? The answer is, not all of them. The USData.gov has been through multiple administrations with very different attitudes toward transparency, and the continuity has been. Some datasets have disappeared, some have stopped being updated. The portal itself persists, but the commitment behind it fluctuates.
Is there a structural fix for that? Something that makes open data harder to kill when the political winds shift?
The UK's open data efforts were backed by a legal requirement for public bodies to publish certain datasets, and that requirement didn't disappear when the government changed. The US passed the Open Government Data Act in 2019, which codified open data as a default requirement for federal agencies. That's not a guarantee. Laws can be ignored or underfunded, but it raises the cost of walking away.
I want to go back to something the prompt raised that I think we've danced around. The distinction between data that lives on the open data portal and data that lives on the statistical agency's own site. The prompt found the consumer price index data on the Central Bureau of Statistics site, not on data.gov.il. And that's not a failure of open data. It's a symptom of something structural. Statistical agencies often have their own publication pipelines, their own formats, their own schedules, and they're not going to migrate all of that to a central portal just because someone stood up a KingCane instance.
Honestly, they probably shouldn't. The statistical agency's site is often better for the data it specializes in because it's purpose-built for that data. The CPI data on the CBS site is going to have better documentation, more detailed breakdowns, historical series, methodology notes, all the things that a general purpose portal strips out. The portal's value isn't in replacing those specialized sites, it's in being a discovery layer that points you to them.
Except that the discovery layer doesn't work if the statistical agency's data isn't indexed there, which, in the Israeli case, it sounds like it wasn't.
And that's a metadata problem. The portal should be harvesting metadata from the statistical agency, not asking the agency to republish everything. CKAN actually supports this. It has a harvester plugin that can pull metadata from other catalogs. But someone has to configure it, and someone has to maintain the relationship with the statistical agency. Again, it's not a technical problem. It's an institutional coordination problem.
We're circling back to the same theme. The technology is rarely the bottleneck. The bottleneck is whether anyone is paid to care.
Whether the people who are paid to care have the authority to make other agencies cooperate.
Let me throw one more example at you that I think is interesting, because it's a case where open data created value in a way nobody predicted. Taiwan's government publishes real-time air quality data from monitoring stations across the island. It was originally published for environmental researchers. But what happened was that a group of citizen developers built an app called Airbox that combined the government data with data from low-cost sensors that they distributed to schools and community centers. The result was a hyperlocal air quality map that was more granular than anything the government could produce on its own. And it became so popular that the government started incorporating the citizen sensor data into its official monitoring system.
That's the loop again, but with a twist. The citizens aren't just analyzing the data, they're contributing to it. It's open data becoming collaborative data.
The key detail is that the government was willing to accept that the citizen data might be messier than its own data, and that the trade-off was worth it for the coverage. That's a level of institutional humility that I don't think we see very often.
There's a similar story in Japan after the Fukushima disaster. The government's radiation monitoring data was sparse and slow to update, so a group called Safecast built a network of citizen radiation sensors and published everything as open data. Their data ended up being more comprehensive and more trusted than the official data, precisely because it was independent. And over time, the government started using Safecast data to fill gaps in its own monitoring.
Which is both inspiring and a little bit damning, right? The citizens had to build the thing the government should have built, because the government wasn't moving fast enough.
Yes, but the government was eventually willing to incorporate it. That's the part that matters for our discussion. An open data culture that's healthy has to be able to say the outsiders did it better and will use their work. That's a hard thing for a bureaucracy to say.
All right, let me try to synthesize what we've been circling around. The prompt asks for examples of open government data done well, where transparency goes beyond uploading a random CSV. We've got the UK's prescribing data saving hundreds of millions of pounds. We've got Chicago's food inspections creating an enforcement feedback loop. We've got Moldova and Ukraine using procurement transparency to fight corruption, with real money saved and real prosecutions. We've got Taiwan and Japan showing collaborative models where citizen data supplements official data. What ties all of these together?
I'd say three things. First, they all started with a clear use case, not a data dump. Second, they all invested in making the data actually usable, proper documentation, consistent formats, regular updates. And third, they all built or supported an intermediary layer of journalists, developers, and researchers who turned raw data into something actionable.
The fourth thing, which I think is the hardest, they all had a government that was willing to be changed by what the data revealed. That's the part you can't fake. You can stand up a Kraken instance in an afternoon. You can upload a few hundred CSVs. You can issue a press release about digital transformation. But if you're not prepared for someone to find something you'd rather they didn't find, and to act on it, you're not doing open data. You're doing open theater.
That's exactly the right term, and I think that's what the prompt was picking up on. The feeling that a lot of these portals are stage sets. The props are there, the lighting is good, but there's no actual play happening.
The airport vendor list as set dressing.
The airport vendor list is the potted plant in the corner of the stage. It's technically part of the production, but nobody came to see it.
I do want to acknowledge one counterpoint before we wrap, which is that sometimes performative transparency is a step on the way to real transparency. A government that publishes airport vendor lists today might publish procurement data tomorrow, if there's enough pressure. The portal existing at all creates a hook that advocates can use. You already have the platform. Now put something useful on it.
That's a fair point. And there are cases where that's exactly what happened. The UK's portal started with a lot of low-value datasets and gradually improved as user feedback accumulated. The US portal went through a similar evolution. The danger is when the portal is treated as the endpoint rather than the starting point. When the press release about launching the portal is the last thing that happens, not the first.
That's where the institutional commitment matters. If there's no budget for maintenance, no staff for curation, no process for responding to user feedback, the portal is just going to sit there and rot. Datasets will stop updating. Links will break. The whole thing will become a monument to a moment of enthusiasm that wasn't sustained.
The half-life of an unmaintained open data portal is surprisingly short. I've seen ones where 30% of the links were dead within 2 years. That's worse than not having a portal at all because it trains users not to trust the platform.
If we're talking to a government that's considering launching an open data portal or revitalizing one that's gone stale, what's the one thing we'd tell them?
Hire someone whose full-time job is making the portal useful and give them the authority to make other agencies cooperate. Everything else flows from that. The technology is secondary. The policies are secondary. The press releases are secondary. You need a person who wakes up every day thinking about whether the data is findable, usable, and actually being used. If you're not willing to pay for that person, don't bother launching the portal.
The chief data officer has the make or break variable. I buy that. And I'd add, give that person a public feedback channel and require them to publish what they heard and what they did about it. The transparency has to apply to the transparency effort itself.
I love it.
With that kind of podcast. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In 1943, a German cargo ship carrying a hold full of dried bladderwrack seaweed ran aground on the skeleton coast of Namibia. The crew survived, but the seaweed, harvested from the North Atlantic for alginate production, scattered across the beach and briefly created a small, accidental kelp processing industry among local fishermen who had never encountered that species before. The entire operation collapsed within 6 months when termites ate the drying racks.
Termites ate the drying racks? Of course they did.
A German seaweed shipwreck creating a 6-month micro-industry in the Namib Desert. I have no follow-up, so here's the forward-looking thought I want to leave with. The open data movement is about 15 years old now. The platforms exist. The CKAN instances are spun up. The question for the next decade isn't, will governments publish data? Enough of them will, at least performatively. The question is whether the feedback loops will close, whether the data will actually change how governments behave. And that depends less on technology and more on whether citizens, journalists, and researchers keep showing up to do the hard work of turning raw data into accountability. The portals are just infrastructure. The accountability is the product. The examples we found, the UK, Chicago, Moldova, Taiwan, suggest that it can work. It's not a fantasy. The loop can close. But it takes sustained effort on both sides, and it takes a government that's willing to hear things it doesn't want to hear. That's rare, but it's not impossible.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this operation running. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com, and if you've got a prompt you'd like us to dig into, that's where you send it. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.